Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question and answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. John Bateman. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you and good morning. Thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email, and I'll spell it. It's NESDIS.PA@NOAA.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory. If you don't have the link, I will also spell that out for you now. It is https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/BRIEFINGS. With that, I will introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Karen Gleason, a climatologist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the July U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is Samantha Borisov, a climatologist with the Northeast Regional Climate Center at Cornell University, who will discuss the recent record heat across the Northeast, as well as the emerging drought over the last couple of months. And our third presenter is Matt Rosenkranz, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the temperature, precipitation, and drought outlook for the months of September, October, and November. Our first speaker will be Karen from NOAA.
Thank you, John, and thanks everyone for joining our call today. Let's begin on slide number two and review some of the highlights for the global temperatures that we observed during the month of July. So the July 2020 global land and ocean surface temperature departure of 0.92 degrees Celsius or 1.66 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average tied with 2016 as the second highest July global temperature since records began in 1880. This value was only 0.01 degrees Celsius or 0.02 degrees Fahrenheit shy of tying the record warm July of 2019. Looking at global land by itself, the departure was 1.23 degrees Celsius or 2.21 degrees Fahrenheit above average, which is the second warmest July behind 2017. Looking at our global oceans by themselves, the departure was 0.80 degrees Celsius or 1.44 degrees Fahrenheit above the departure or above average, which translates to the third warmest July. Looking at the map on the left, which is our land and ocean temperature departure from average for the month, we see that the month was characterized by warmer than average temperatures across much of the global land and ocean surface area. Warmer than average values are denoted with shades of red, whereas shades of blue indicate areas of below average temperatures. So the most notable warm temperature departures of 2 degrees Celsius or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit were present across the North Pacific Ocean, the southwestern and northeastern contiguous United States, eastern Canada, and across parts of western Asia and eastern Antarctica. According to the July 2020 percentiles map, which is located on the lower right-hand side of the slide, cooler than average July temperatures were limited to small parts of northern North America, the northern Atlantic Ocean, Scandinavia, eastern China, southern South America, and the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean, no land or ocean areas had a record cold July temperature. Record warm July temperatures were widespread across the North Indian Ocean, Southeastern Asia, and the Western Pacific Ocean. Other areas with record warm July temperatures were present across parts of the Caribbean Sea, Northern South America, North America, and the North Pacific Ocean. Regionally speaking, we saw that the Caribbean region had its warmest July on record with a temperature departure of 1.24 degrees Celsius or 2.23 degrees Fahrenheit above average. This eclipsed the previous record set in 2016, and as a point of note, the Caribbean region's five warmest Julys have occurred since 1998. North America had its second warmest July on record, and only July of 2020 was warmer, and Asia reported its third warmest July. So now moving on to slide number three, we see that the January to July global land and ocean surface temperature departure was 1.05 degrees Celsius or 1.89 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and was the second warmest such period in the 141-year record. Only the year-to-date period of 2016 was warmer by 0.04 degrees Celsius or 0.07 degrees Fahrenheit above the average. Looking at land only, we had a departure of 1.73 degrees Celsius or 3.11 degrees Fahrenheit above average. And global oceans by themselves was 0.79 degrees Celsius or 1.42 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Each of these subdivisions, global land and ocean together, land only and ocean only, were each second warmest behind 2016. And if you take a look at the year-to-date global temperatures graph on the lower right-hand side of the slide, 2020 is denoted by the black line with the black dots, one for each month. And we see that 2020 is trailing behind 2016 through July, but ahead of 2019 and 2017 at this point, which were neck and neck in a virtual tie. Looking at the percentiles map on the left, we see that during January to July, record warm temperatures were present across a large portion of northern Asia and across parts of Europe, southern China, Mexico, the Caribbean, South America, and the Atlantic, northern Indian, and Pacific Oceans. According to our regional analysis, Europe, Asia, the Caribbean region, and the Gulf of Mexico had their warmest January to July since regional records began in 1910. And looking at the bottom of the slide in our 2020 Global Annual Temperature Ranking Outlook, which is a statistical analysis created by NCEI scientists, the year 2020 is very likely to rank among the five warmest years on record, and there is currently a 37% chance that 2020 could be the warmest year on record. And then turning our attention to slide number four, we'll get a little closer to home and look at the contiguous U.S. for July. The average temperature was 75.7 degrees Fahrenheit, which was 2.21 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term average. This is the 11th warmest July on record. Looking at the map on the left-hand side of the slide, the temperature percentiles map, we see that above average temperatures were observed across parts of the west, the southwest, the southern plains, and the central Rockies, and then from the Mississippi River Valley all the way to the east coast. Several states reported their warmest or tied for their warmest July on record, and that included Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, New Hampshire, Virginia, and Connecticut. The Northeast region as a whole had its warmest July and month on record. I'm sure Samantha will touch on some of those aspects here in just a moment. Looking at precipitation on average for the month, it was 2.93 inches, which was 0.15 inch above average, which actually translates to slightly above average when we look at it from a historical perspective. We see that above average precipitation occurred across much of the northern and central plains, the Great Lakes, the Mississippi Valley, and the Gulf Coast. Kansas actually had its seventh wettest month on record, or July on record. We also saw, conversely, drier than average conditions, which fell across much of the west, western U.S., portions of the Deep South, the Central Plains, the Ohio Valley, and Southeast. Arizona reported its sixth driest July on record, and Nevada its 11th driest. All right, turning our attention now to slide number five, looking at the year-to-date period, January through July, we see that the temperature average was 53.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 2.4 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean. This year-to-date period is the seventh warmest on record. Looking at the map on the left, our temperature percentiles map, we see all of the state ranks are above average to record warm, with Florida reporting its warmest January to July on record. There was lots of near record heat ranking-wise across the Northeast. And there were a few pockets of near average temperatures across portions of the Northern Rockies and parts of the Northern Plains and parts of the South. Looking at precipitation, the year-to-date precipitation total is 19.29 inches, which is 1.20 inches above average. We saw above average precipitation present across portions of the Northwest, the Central Plains, from the Great Lakes to the Gulf Coast in the Southeast. Both Tennessee and West Virginia had their fifth wettest January to July on record. Drier than average conditions stretched from the West Coast to the Rockies and then the northern and into the Northern Plains and also across portions of the Northeast. Colorado had its eighth driest January to July on record, and Utah its 11th driest. Looking at the current U.S. drought monitor on slide number 6, which was released this morning, we see that approximately 37% of the contiguous U.S. is currently in drought. This is up, or the footprint of drought has increased by about 4 percentage points since late July. We did see some improvement or some lessening of drought conditions across parts of the Central Plains and the Great Lakes during this time, but we also saw drought grow or intensify across portions of the West, Southwest, Central Rockies, across portions of West and Central Texas, and Iowa, as well as across portions of New England. Looking outside the contiguous U.S., we saw drought eliminated across Puerto Rico, and we saw drought contract in parts of Hawaii, mainly the Big Island, and Alaska remains drought-free at the moment. And with that, I will turn it over to Samantha.
Great, thanks, Karen. So in slide 7, the entire Northeast experienced above normal temperatures this July, generally 2 to 6 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. The month was persistently warm with very few days that were colder than normal, and both high and low temperatures were warmer than normal. On slide 8, we typically look at a subset of about 35 long-term climate sites, and July was the all-time hottest month on record for 11 of those long-term climate sites, which are shaded yellow in the table on the left. The month ranked among the 5 all-time hottest months on record at another 18 of those long-term climate sites. In addition, we had 7 long-term climate sites that had their greatest number of days with a high of at least 90 degrees Fahrenheit of any month on record, which are shaded yellow in the table on the right. So, for instance, there were only 3 days during July that didn't reach 90 degrees Fahrenheit in Washington, D.C., and the number of 90-degree days ranked among the 10 greatest for any month on record at another 17 of those long-term climate sites. On slide 9, not only has it been hot, but parts of the Northeast, particularly New York and New England and even Pennsylvania, have been drier than normal. So in May, which is that top left map, areas shaded dark orange or red saw less than 75 or less than 3/4 of their normal precipitation for the month of May. In June, which is the top center map, several areas saw less than half or less than 50% of their normal precipitation for June, and those areas are the ones that are shaded red. And in July, which is the top right map, precipitation was extremely hit or miss. We still had some locations seeing less than 75% of normal precipitation for the month of July. And so with that, drought and abnormally dry conditions did develop across the Northeast. And the drought monitor map on the bottom right is from late July. On slide 10, here's another way to show the increasing dryness across portions of the Northeast. So the zero line across the top is normal, and the 3 lines sloping down to the right represent the precipitation departures at Caribou, Maine, Hartford, Connecticut, and Worcester, Massachusetts. So basically, there's been a downward trend since at least May 1st, and as of the end of July, these sites were running anywhere from 4 to 9 inches below normal for precipitation for that period. Actually, this May 1st through July 31st period ranked as the driest on record for Hartford and the second driest for Caribou and Worcester. And we're still seeing below normal precipitation, above normal temperatures, and drought conditions through mid-August in the Northeast. And now I'll turn it over to Matt.
So this is Matthew Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. Moving on to slide 11, the update that we did for status of ENSO for this year, we did measure below normal sea surface temperatures across the equatorial Pacific. Those equatorial central Pacific sea surface temperatures have cooled during the month from when you do a measurement from July into early August. But they did warm slightly across the eastern Pacific. They are still below normal across the entire basin, so that is kind of indicative of the being on the cold side of ENSO neutral and the potential for La Nina to develop. The potential for La Nina to develop is encapsulated in the La Nina watch that the Climate Prediction Center has issued, with La Nina likely to develop during autumn with a 60% chance of development. La Nina is likely to continue through winter 2021 with a 55% chance of it continuing. Then as we go through next spring, we return to kind of more climatological odds, more normal patterns that we would expect through next March, April, May. Moving to slide 12, the monthly forecast, it does call for above normal temperatures being favored across much of Alaska, except for the panhandle, where there is equal chances, which means a more distribution similar to climatology. The highest odds for above normal temperatures are across the northern and western portions of Alaska. In the contiguous U.S., the highest odds for above normal temperatures are in the southwest U.S., where long-term trends strongly favor above normal temperatures. There is a continuation of above normal temperatures likely in the northeast as well, with greater than 50% chance of above normal temperatures from upstate New York over to Massachusetts and then northward into Maine. There is a large area of equal chances in the temperature forecast that extends from the Mississippi Valley, Central Great Plains, over to the southeast coast, where we do expect more variable conditions, and we did not have any strong climatological signals for above normal temperatures nor below normal temperatures. For the precipitation outlook for September, we do expect a continuation of the below normal precipitation for much of the southwest region, extending over towards the Central Plains and kind of middle Mississippi Valley. Above normal precipitation is favored in the southeast U.S. That was supported in some trends, as well as some of the dynamical models, and as well as the potential for any tropical cyclone activity to impact that region. Moving to slide 13, the seasonal forecast for September, October, November. That seasonal forecast does strongly favor above normal temperatures for the for most of Alaska and for the entire contiguous state in the U.S. The highest odds for above normal temperatures are actually on the northern coast of Alaska, where normally, in the long record, they would have sea ice approaching the northern edge there. But the sea ice is at onset, or that approaching of the northern shore of Alaska, has been getting later and later every year. So it leads to some very strong trends along the north shore of Alaska and the western coast of Alaska as well. And that's very much represented in the October-November time period, which was the traditional onset of that ice edge approaching the coast of Alaska. For the lower 48, the highest odds for above normal temperatures are centered around the Four Corners region. The trends during September, October, November do indicate a 15-year trend that's a little over 1 degree centigrade. So the trends are quite strong there. Compared to last month, there was a slight reduction in odds for above normal temperatures across the Pacific Northwest and a little bit across the Northern Plains. That is related to the more certainty of a La Nina coming, which would favor more variability across the northern Rockies, as well as a slight shift towards a bit of below normal temperatures across that region. The strongest impacts from the La Nina are typically in the winter time frame, so beyond the scope of this outlook. So it's only slightly impacted into this outlook. For precipitation,
The more certainty towards La Nina would favor above normal precipitation in the Pacific Northwest, with continued below normal precipitation kind of in the Great Basin and the southern Sierra Nevadas over to the lower Mississippi Valley. The seasonal outlook for September, October, November does reflect the potential for an enhanced tropical cyclone or hurricane season in the Atlantic. So we do favor above normal odds or above normal precipitation in the southeast, basically from New Orleans up to the Carolina coast and the entrance to the Chesapeake Bay. There is also in the southwest, there's a bit of an area of equal chances in southern Arizona and southwest New Mexico, where we can, in October, mainly see some recurring moisture coming out of the eastern Pacific. It's most likely in late September and early October. And there were some models showing that, so we didn't extend the signal for below normal precipitation all the way to the southwest. Moving on to slide 14, the seasonal drought outlook reflects the precipitation outlook greatly. So where we had the below normal precipitation favored, we do forecast drought development in portions of California, as well as the central and southern plains. But everywhere from California over to Wyoming, Nebraska, and down to western Texas, anywhere that's currently experiencing drought, we are not forecasting any drought relief in that area. We are forecasting drought relief and amelioration in the Pacific Northwest, especially as during this period of September, October, November, they typically get into their raining season. And then we also did forecast some drought relief into the Northeast and across the Northern Plains as typically during, as you move through the autumn, the demand for precipitation or demand for moisture in the ground will alleviate somewhat as crops are harvested and as the temperatures come down quite a bit. So that's all I have, and back to John.
All right, thanks so much, Matt. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question, if possible. Chelsea, could you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly when prompted. If you'd like to withdraw your question, press star two. The first question comes from Seth Bornstein from Associated Press. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you for doing this. And Karen and Matt, you both are filling in some big shoes there. This is for Matt. Looking at the ENSA, the La Nina that's forecast, first off, how is this forecast to be sort of a moderate mild or a mild one or a strong La Nina? And can you tell us a little bit about what this means for a couple of the major impacts like the fire season, bad fire season we're seeing out west, California, Colorado, those types of places, and in terms of course, of as we head into peak hurricane season, what are we looking at because of the La Nina?
Matt Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. The forecast for La Nina, we don't actually do a forecast for intensity at the moment. That is a developmental product that we're working on. I can't really tell you if it's, the official forecast having a intensity forecast for La Nina. Some of the models that we look at do have quite strong signatures for a near record La Nina, but others are also just slightly into the La Nina category. So there's still quite a range in the dynamical models and also the statistical tools that we look at. The impact of La Nina would really be manifested in the in basically a below normal precipitation signature across the southern tier of the U.S., basically all the way from California into the southeast. And that's most often felt into the core of the winter. The direct impacts for fire weather are going to be highly variable locally, depending on what fuels they have, depending on what actual conditions set up there on a week-to-week basis. So that's really a question that the National Interagency Fire Center and the Bureau of Land Management, when they do their fire weather outlooks, they can probably give you a much better answer on that because they monitor all of those variables more closely. As far as the hurricane outlook, we are in a long-term active period for the multi-decadal signal from 95 onwards, and La Nina would only serve to enhance that signal. So we are still forecasting that above normal season, which it would potentially mean that you could have it extend a little bit later into the year. That's typically what happens when you have these above normal seasons. You get the storms that kind of go into December slightly more frequently. We also have slightly more intense storms. So it's really time to take the time to prepare now. We even have a tropical depression that was declared this morning with some of the tracks moving that could impact the U.S.
Two of them. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one, unmute your phone, and record your name clearly when prompted. It'll just be one moment while we wait on our next question. Showing no further questions at this time, I'd like to turn the conference back over to Mr. John Bateman.
All right. Thanks so much, Chelsea. Though, since there are no further questions, I will now wrap up the call. First, I'd like to thank all of the speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in this conference call. I will end by reminding you all to mark your calendar for a few upcoming releases. The release of the August 2020 U.S. climate statistics is scheduled for September 9th. The release for the August 2020 global climate statistics is scheduled for September 14th. And the next media telecon for the August U.S. and global climate report, which will also include a review of the summer of 2020, will be at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, September 17th. Finally, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov media advisory site later today. If you have any further informational needs, please email me at nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. My contact information is also available at the top of the media advisory. This concludes today's call. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference. All participants may disconnect at this time.